is on in less than 1 minute.
Life, you hear me? Give my creation life.
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Get countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast area.
Your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Oh, you better believe it. All that's left is the truth. We've got the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth for you today here on the Guy James Show, as we do every day. Welcome and hello from the beautiful blue waters and sandy beaches of Southwest Florida, Naples, Fort Myers area. Awfully glad to be with you today. I betcha. And I couldn't wait to say that. I say that every chance I get nowadays. I betcha. Golly gee and all that. I can't help it. It's just, I'm just all bubbly since Sarah Palin's entered the race. I just, you know, just puts me in a good mood every time I hear her. Not. It's getting to be when I hear the woman. And I'm sorry. Here I go. Just starting off again. Fingernails on a blackboard or all that is much more mellow sounding than her voice. Oh my God. I just can't stand it. I cannot stand it. But anyway, I promise I won't say anything else about Sarah Palin the rest of the show. Although I want you to know I have my fingers crossing behind my back. Awfully good to have you with us. I spend the whole weekend, as much of it I can. I shouldn't say it that way. Saturdays, after around 4 o'clock is the one time of the week that I get to just relax and enjoy myself. And I watch college football and I love college football and I usually go to sleep Saturday night with the TV still on watching college football. I even watched a game the other night with, James Madison University. I forget who, but I watched my beloved Buckeyes, and that was like watching paint dry this week, although they did win. And, of course, the Michigan Wolverines were beaten by mighty Toledo University. And, of course, I know Bob is happy as when West Virginia Mountaineers won. So that's what I do for enjoyment on Saturday evening, watch college football and all that. And, oh, gosh, I went to the, I think I made a mistake. I went to the doctor yesterday, and I've got like, oh, a little dark spot on my cheek that's been getting, you know, it's not a mole or anything like that, just, I don't know if it's an H spot or what, but I go to the doctor yesterday, the doctor says, yeah, I said, I can take care of that. And I'm going away next week. By the way, I will not be here live next week because I'm going to be traveling. And so I thought, well, I want to get that spot taken care of. And I'm at the doctor yesterday. Why am I telling you this? I'm at the doctor yesterday. He says, sure, I can take care of that. Let me get this liquid nitrogen out and spray it, and it'll just, boom, it'll be gone tomorrow. Well, yeah. They sprayed that one and another little spot on me, and now I got these real dark spots on my face, two of them. If I had a webcam here, I'd show you, but now I'm concerned. when I go away this week, am I going to look like a leopard here? Or I don't know. And I surely don't know why I'm telling you this. Good to have all of you along with us today. News from Florida. Charlie Crist, Governor Charlie Crist, our governor who can't decide what he is. Let me clarify that. He can't decide what he wants to be in the middle or Republican or Democrat. But, you know, when his name was being mentioned for being the VP of John McNasty, well, he was right in there pitching. And he was right in there pitching for a little while afterwards. And it seemed like Charlie hasn't shown up at all the events in Florida. And actually, he was up until last week. In fact, he was at this one not far from here called Alico Arena, where our skinhead sheriff made an ass of himself. And by the way, he made such an ass of himself, he will still win overwhelmingly in Lee County, Florida, as a sheriff. That gives you an idea what it's like here. But Charlie was there. But Charlie, along with a few other people, are kind of bailing off the McCain ship night right now, kind of like the rats getting off of a sinking ship, if you know what I mean, and this is a sinking ship. I think we'll all agree on that. It is a sinking ship, and barring some kind of a freak anomaly miracle or whatever, Mr. McCain is going to go down in defeat, and go down in defeat and shame, I might add. But Mr. McCain had an event here in Florida the other day, and Charlie Crist was going to be there. Originally, he was scheduled to be there, and he didn't go because he had to go to Disney World instead. And I'm not kidding. He went to Disney World instead. And they asked him about, well, Charlie, are you going to be campaigning for Senator McCain now or not? And he says, well, I will if I have time. That doesn't sound very enthusiastic to me, does it to you? I will if I have time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, along with Bill Kristol and Tommy Thompson and Romney and a host of others, they're all jumping off the ship. And Billy Kristol wants the McPalin ticket to go back to being themselves, he says. Hell, they are being themselves, Bill. They're the selves that they've exhibited for years. They are nasty, mean-spirited, conniving individuals who absolutely lust for power and misuse it when they get it. And McCain proved his untrustworthiness with Charles Keating and years ago, and McPalin has proven it in many different respects, and they're all starting to come out. And I'll bet you Sarah didn't really enjoy the welcome that she got by the Philadelphia Flyers fans the other night. By golly, I'll bet she didn't. No. She didn't like that one little bit, I would say. And Sarah also, I don't know what they're thinking, but these people are so unashamed. They're so unabashedly, what's the word I'm looking for? Morally bankrupt. And they are. That she takes what should have been a rock to the side of the head the other day on Friday when it came out about this Troopergate thing. As well, you know, I'm really glad that I've been absolved of any wrongdoing or any anything legally wrong or any ethics violation. Well, wait a minute. You said you've been absolved of any problem with ethics violation? Did it not say that specifically in this report? That you were, in fact, guilty of ethics violations. Now, it's not an impeachable offense in Alaska. It's not something that they're going to get her thrown out of office for. But she lied about it. She knew damn well her husband was exerting pressure on the state to try and get rid of this brother-in-law of hers. She knew that. And, you know, I don't have a big problem with that. If she really and truly felt the guy was that bad and she wanted to use a little leverage that she has about it, well, politicians do that. And I, I know they do it. They do it on both sides of the aisle. There's very few of them that don't use a little influence now and then. And although it was wrong, I'm not going to sit here and be hypocritical and say, oh, my God, that's the worst thing that ever happened in the world that she did that, because it isn't. And I know many politicians have done many things wrong, and you hear me talk about them here on both sides of the aisle. And I'm going to get to that in a moment. Another story about that in just a moment. So I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, God, she tried to get her ex-brother-in-law fired, and what a terrible thing that was. That's nothing. The fact is that what's wrong with this is, once again, it's the cover-up. It's the cover-up. I am convinced to this day that if Richard Nixon would have stepped out in front of the American public and said, you know what? Some of my underlings got carried away, did a little political espionage, got caught, and all this. I'm sorry. I humbly apologize. I am so sorry that this happened. They got carried away with their enthusiasm, and, G. Gordon Liddy's a rat, and I now know it. If Nixon would have done that, I almost think the Republican, the American people would have said, well, all right, we don't like this. We don't like this, but all right. But no, they got to go ahead and bowl their way through it. And, McPalin, Sarah Palin lied about this. It's obvious she lied through her teeth. Her husband lied through his teeth. Everybody in Alaska knows they lied about it. That's the point. If you're caught, give it up. Just give it up. If you're caught, plead insanity, plead ignorance, I'm sorry, whatever. That's the thing. Now we know that besides just trying to use a little influence, that she cannot be trusted on anything. It's just like, McCain. Back when he wrote his book, he said that he'd made a mistake. He'd made a big mistake in the Keating 5. Now he has completely forgotten that he ever said that he was contrite about that. Now it's something different. But they are jumping off, and rats are jumping off the ship. And the campaign has been extremely ugly and getting uglier every day, despite the fact that Mr. McCain has tried to put things right. I don't know if he's really so much tried to put things right. It's just the fact that he wanted to take away a little of the sting to his own campaign, because the public has gotten wise to his 100% negative ads. They have gotten wise to the fact that he sent this woman from Alaska, this political, I don't know what to call her. I don't know what to call the woman. I don't know that I've got a good word for it. She on the one hand, she's conniving. She knows how to play the political game in spades. She knows how to stand up there and lie through her teeth and be convincing about it and smile and nod and be so nice and all that. And on the other hand, on some things, she's just absolutely clueless. Clueless. So I can't think of any words to really describe her. I found a little audio cut here. John Cleese. You remember John Cleese, the actor on Monty Python and all. I'll let him explain it.
What do you think about Sarah Palin when you...
I used to think Michael Palin was the funniest Palin on earth. What fascinates me, though, is how people watching her on television, can they not see that she's basically learned certain speeches? And she does them very well. She's got a very good memory. But it's like a nice-looking parrot, because the parrot speaks beautifully and kind of says, "Oh, shucks," every now and again, but doesn't really have any understanding of the meaning of the words that it is producing, even though it's producing them very accurately. And she's been in these training sessions with Cheney's pals, and she's learned these speeches. And the extraordinary thing is that so many people are taken in by it. And the truth is that Sarah Palin is no way good enough. And if you lined up from Europe, left-wingers, centrists, right-wingers, you wouldn't find 10%. You probably wouldn't find 5% who think she's good enough to run the United States. And she's running as the partner of a 72-year-old cancer survivor. I mean, Monty Python could have written this. And I'm sorry, Michael Palin, to say you're not the funniest Palin anymore, but you're not.
John Cleese, I love the guy. I always did. I always thought he was tremendously funny. Just always liked everything that I think he ever did. I find him absolutely humorous. But he kind of sums it up for me on Sarah Palin, so I'll try not too much to talk about it anymore today. But you all know that, of course, John McCain has said now that he's got us right where he wants us, right? Yeah, he's got us right where he wants us. And, of course, they've got these ugly mobs now at a lot of their campaign stops. Ugly mobs. And that's exactly what they are. And I think the last game, last time we were together, I think I played you a little bit of an ugly mob. But where do I have this here? Maybe I don't have it. I thought I did. It's just, it's very upsetting, some of the things these people in these lines. Here we go. Some more McCain, Palin, crazy people. And that takes in just about everybody waiting in lines to see Sarah Palin or John McCain. It is amazing to watch independent or biased, it doesn't matter, reporters go down those lines and ask them. They're not singling people out, mind you. They're just going down the line and indiscriminately picking people out and saying, what do you think? And here's some more of the responses.
And one thing we don't need is another lawyer in Washington, and that's Barack Obama. He's a lawyer.
I think you're stupid.
Bye, sir.
Because that guy gets elected, he hangs around with terrorists.
Who's the terrorist?
Obama.
Obama's a terrorist, don't you know that?
Obama's a Muslim, he's a terrorist himself.
Do you really believe that, sir? Do you really believe that? You believe that Senator Obama's a terrorist?
I believe he supports terrorism.
Here it is! Love it!
Swine. You're gonna go to Russia.
Screw Obama. Boo. My cowboys.
European socialist.
You think they
spill airs, scumbag?
You think they should die, sir? You think they should die?
Everyone dies, don't they?
And then you kill babies. 50 million babies killed from abortion. He can't protect the most innocent. He can't protect us.
Caitlin voted to have women pay for their own rape kits. My friend shouldn't have to pay for their own rape kits. How do you feel about that?
She should die.
Rape kits. Oh, rape kits.
Make sure they're not paying for their own rape kits.
I'm horrible.
So is Senator Obama an American too?
I don't know what he is.
Let's register more dead people for Obama.
What's your concern about ACARN, sir?
I think that Acorn is the sleaziest, most despicable, corrupt, immoral, good friend of our friend Barack, sleazy scum of the earth.
Okay.
Let me. How shall I put this?
Can you be more specific?
Yeah, I can be more specific.
No, seriously, what have they done?
What have they done? Them and their buddy Obama, have single-handedly brought this financial catastrophe on our country through their dealings with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Barack Obama is the second most highest paid person from Acorn, who registers dead people and buses homeless people from state to state. Where do I stop?
We're on the sidewalk to nowhere.
Oh, yeah. There is your average crowd at your McCallan. You know, I've gotten myself to the point I can't say their names properly. At the McCain-Palin rallies. Those are the people that you run into. And I don't know what to say other than, wow. Are McCain and Palin responsible for these ugly mobs? Yes, of course they are. They're now, you know, their campaign people are coming out and saying, well, they can't be responsible for an occasional crazy in the mob. You know, they're not responsible for that. They are responsible for this ugliness. They're out there every day with inflammatory speeches. But the one thing we all have to remember is that extremism has been and always will be present in the political arena. This is nothing new for the Republicans. Do remember that it was Barry Goldwater who said extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. That was one of his mantras, and oddly enough, many people looked at him as extreme, but he was very much a moderate compared to today's neocon Republicans, your average Republican. And in the study of psychology, you're going to find that if you have a group of people who all share the same political beliefs, that they will ultimately become extreme because they won't hear anything but their own beliefs and those around them that have the same beliefs, making them believe that they're always right no matter what. If you're with somebody that believes 2 and 2 is 5, and everybody around you believes 2 and 2 is 5, and you all retort that back and forth from one to another, this group is convinced that 2 and 2 is 5. And so when you get people that have the same political beliefs, they're ultimately going to become extreme because they won't hear anything but their own beliefs, making them believe that they're right no matter what. And then, therefore, they become even more extreme. And we have to consider the fact that if you have a group that's extreme, there'll be sort of a contest for leadership. And those that are seeking the leadership roles are kind of going to see it as an advantage to be just a little bit more extreme than the rest of them. And that, to themselves at least, and maybe to the others as well, makes themselves seem to be a better neocon than the rest, more devout in their beliefs if they're a little more extreme. You aren't just any radical neocon, you're the pack leader at that point. And it's not just Republicans who have this problem. The fringes on both sides are vulnerable to this sort of thing. The only thing is that so far in this campaign, the Democratic candidates have, to their great credit, have kept the loonies from coming out of the woodwork, and the Republicans have not. It's that simple. The Republicans, the McPalin-McCain campaign, has encouraged that kind of behavior at their rallies. They have not put it down at all. And fortunately, we have no reports of anything like that happening at an Obama rally, but I can tell you this much, and you know this to be true, that if Barack Obama were standing in front of the stage and somebody yelled, "Kill him," you can bet Barack Obama would stop that person in their tracks and admonish them for saying such a horrible thing. You can bet that's what would happen. The Democratic candidates have, in my opinion, they've remained cool, calm, and rational. While this Republican ticket has gone out and preached hatred and divisiveness, and that's the difference. And I'm afraid some of this gets us to the point where we can't put the genie back in the bottle. I'm afraid that the hate that is being preached right now and the hate that you just heard from these lines of people waiting to get into the Palin-McCain rallies, that kind of hatred is dangerous for America. It's dangerous to our way of life. It is not. In fact, it is the antithesis of what these people like to stand up and say, well, they're so American. They were singing God Bless America. How can you sit there and sing God Bless America when a little bit before someone yelled, kill him? How can you sing God Bless America and claim to be a patriot and wrap yourself in a flag when you're standing there saying the opposite side is a terrorist and a Muslim and all this and that, these charges that they make? How can you do that? First of all, by engaging in that type of behavior, you're exposing your ignorance. And the average IQ, I'd hate to say what the average IQ of these people waiting to get into these McCain-Palin rallies really is. I'm sorry, but I've seen half a dozen videos now taken down along these lines. And I have to tell you, I'm not impressed with the intelligence that we're seeing. Not impressed at all. And then you've got McCain on the tube telling us that, oh, they're saying bad things about me at the Obama rallies, too. First of all, has he been to an Obama rally? I can tell you this. I have not heard a single report of someone yelling out, kill him, at an Obama or a Biden rally. Have you? If you have, let me know. And if you have proof of it, let me know. But I have not. And I had the pain of, had to endure the pain of watching a little bit of Hannity yesterday, or listening a little bit of Hannity, because I was on the lookout for something I knew he was going to say. Is there any more of a hate monger anywhere than this little clown Hannity? Is there a worse one than him? I've gotten, and I'm not kidding about this, I've gotten so that if anyone says to me that they're a fan of Sean Hannity, that they listen to him and believe him, and they like his beliefs and his thoughts, I just tell them, I can't talk to you. I won't talk to you. You are not worth a moment of my time. And I have done so. I have done that. And it's not even rude. It's not rude at all. If someone stands and tells me they're a fan of Sean Hannity, and they believe his crazy, radical beliefs, his absolutely hate-filled speech that he comes across with every day, and at least Limbaugh is more of a clown, more of an entertainer, Hannity lives and breathes the hatred, and you can hear it in his voice. You can hear the hatred in his voice, and he's done everything he can to stir up as much of it as possible. So, I'm not kidding when someone tells me that they're a Hannity disciple. You're a great American, Sean. I have the greatest contempt for that person. It's not one of these things where I say, well, we've got to agree to disagree. No, that's where the line is drawn. We can agree to disagree on many different things, but we cannot agree to disagree on an issue like a hate monger like Sean Hannity. I have tried to get a response from him. I have tried to get a word from his people, from him, anything about his yelling fire in a crowded theater, and that is exactly what he's doing. And, of course, there's no word from any of them ever. He is a despicable human being. I very much regret when I was at the Democratic National Convention and being so in such close proximity to him the entire time I was there. during broadcast hours. I very much respect just not starting one with him out in the hall, not getting all over him about it. I didn't want to be disrespectful to the Democrats running the campaign, but I would like to have started a real verbal Donnybrook with the likes of Sean Hannity. You know he can't stand and defend his views only with his radical, crazy, neocon hate speech. But I guess I talked too much about him, but it's an ugly thing, very ugly thing. And I think these people have fostered hatred. A couple of interesting things. First of all, in the interest of fairness, and I hope that I am nothing if not fair on this program, I do try and always point out the good things and bad things about both sides. Tim Mahoney, Democratic congressman, took the place of a disgraced Republican here in Florida. Had all these ads about what a great family man I am and all that. Now we find that he's made a $121,000 payment to a former mistress who worked on his staff and was threatened to sue him. According to the current and former members of his staff who've been briefed on the settlement, which involved Mahoney and his campaign committee, poor Bob Graham was out there stumping for him to get him elected. $121,000 Mahoney made this payoff. Why didn't he just come out and say, you know, admit it? He should have known he was going to get exposed anyway. That's the problem. Once again, here we go with the cover-up. I talk a lot about Republican ethics problem, and I feel the need to report on this. This is not acceptable, a payoff like this, and Mahoney needs to go. He needs to go right now. When his predecessor was in, at least he had the good sense to get out. Mark Foley, I'm talking about. He had the good sense to get out. They pretty much forced him out. The Republicans did. They went and told him to his face, we will not back you anymore. We would just as soon you get the hell out of the Congress of the United States. And he did. Give him credit for that. They tried to cover it up a bit first, and then finally when the truth was going to come out, that was it. And I'm not just saying this because the Democrats will have a huge majority in the House with or without Mahoney. There is no room for payoffs going on of $121,000. Sexual harassment is what it was over. And hush money. There's no room for that in this country's leadership, plain and simple. And while I'm at it, I think Nancy Pelosi should get on the Capitol steps and say that William Jefferson isn't worthy of democratic values either. Make examples of these people. That's absolutely what should be done. Make examples of them. Have no sympathy for them. Speaking of having no sympathy, I hear John McCain is going to bring up the William Ayers affair. He has told many people that he's going to bring it up tomorrow night at the debate. I welcome that. I think the idea that Obama will stand there and tell you the truth about what happened, what his involvement is, I think he will absolutely convince the American people there was nothing untoward on his part whatsoever. And I love the line that John McCain has been using over and over and over again. And it goes something like this, paraphrasing, I don't need any advice on honesty and ethics and morals. And if I ever did, I wouldn't ask a Democratic politician from Chicago for it. Well, maybe you just ought to ask, John. Because I'm convinced, and time will tell, but I'm convinced that the little note I'm about to read you would never have been written by one Barack Obama. In 1986, John McCain wrote a political note, and I know this is a long time ago. I know it, but it still speaks to the character of this man. In 1986, John McCain wrote a political note on official House of Representatives stationery, apologizing to Charles Keating Jr. for his campaign having listed his good friend and supporter as part of McCain's Senate Campaign Finance Committee. And Keating responded with a handwritten note addressed to Senator 7 months before McCain won his seat, telling him not to sweat it. And Keating says, don't be silly. You can call me anything, write anything, or do anything. I'm yours till death do us part. Well, isn't that just precious? Find me a note like that about John, about Barack Obama, Mr. McCain. And I will seriously listen to what you have to say tomorrow night, if you do, in fact, have the guts to bring up the William Ayers story. We're going to pause for a break right now here on the Guy James Show, 866-546-5254, 866-546-5254.
If you don't clean up your room, the Board of Health is going to condemn it.
The Board of Health doesn't even know about your room. What's more, they don't care.
You know, if you keep making that face, it's going to freeze that way.
Not unless you're someplace really, really cold. Actually, a lot of the warnings moms hand out are a bit exaggerated.
If you don't get your blood pressure checked, you could have high blood pressure, not even know it, and you could die from a stroke.
But she's right about that one. Fact is, high blood pressure contributes to 200,000 American deaths each year, and a third of those who have high blood pressure don't know it. If they did, it'd be simple to treat. Call the American Heart Association at 1-800-AHA-USA1 or visit AmericanHeart.org on the web to learn more. Better still, ask your doctor to check your blood pressure.
If you run without scissors,
it's the least you can do.
If you change your mind, take a chance on the touching line. Honey, I'm still free. Take a chance on me. If you need me, let me know. Gonna be around. If you got no place to go when you're feeling down. If you're all alone, when the pretty birds have flown, honey, I'm still free. Take a chance on me.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Guy James Show. Thank you for being with us this afternoon. Always good to know all of you along with us. I see we've got a good audience this afternoon. That pleases me. Thank you. 866-546-5254. I see Rick Sanchez on CNN. Someone sent me an email that the McCain campaign is livid with CNN for exposing Palin's relationship with the AIP, the Alaskan Independent Party, and they showed the video of Sarah addressing the group's last convention. What, they just now getting around to that? What, we talked about that, 3 days after Sarah Palin was nominated? Is that news? The McCain people say that CNN is furthering the smear? Why? I can't get over that that is news at this time. It has been out there for some time. We certainly talked about it on this program. We certainly immediately played you the audio of Sarah Palin congratulating the AIP convention, told them to keep up the good work and all that. I don't see where this all of a sudden is news. I guarantee you we had that within 3 or 4 days after she was named. So, I don't know. First of all, I don't know why CNN is doing it now, unless it is to incite the campaign to come on over and answer some questions about it. That would be a good thing. And really, I'm finding it surprising that the McCain campaign is just now catching on to this. We know that the chairman of the AIP had talked about the first dude being a member of the AIP for quite a while. We know that he mentioned that Sarah Palin herself had been very supportive of them. At first, it had been reported that she had been a member of the AIP. We really have no evidence of that. But we do know that her husband was, and we do also know from her very words that she's been very supportive of the AIP. And as you all know, the Alaskan Independent Party is a group started by this radical, can't think of his name right offhand, but who called for the secession of Alaska from the United States of America. Remember America First? You remember that? America First? Yeah. Well, yeah, the America First. Her husband was a diehard member of that group. And she always wishes them well and talks to their convention each year that she's been the governor and wished them well. This a group who wants to secede from the United States of America. Yeah, that's America First, all right. Yeah. Those are the kind of organizations, and when we talk about the state of Alaska, and when she said that Alaska is no more than a microcosm of the rest of the country, they've got a lot of places up in Idaho and, you know what I'm talking about, groups that sympathetic with the AIP, the kind of goings-on that the AIP, endorses. So for the campaign right now, Palin-McCain campaign to be upset about this now, Ellis is common knowledge. Very common knowledge. Well, it's common knowledge to you and I. Yes, I will say that the American public has not been exposed to it all that much. Maybe that's what CNN is up to. Very few people know this story. And sometimes I delude myself by saying, well, hell, everybody knows about this. Well, you know it because you keep up with things. My audience knows it. People here on the horn know it because we bring up these things. In fact, many times, we find that we are first in reporting things like that. We're right there at the beginning of it, and sometimes the major networks catch on a day or two later. And you will find, if you listen to our programs, listen to Bob, listen to Mark, listen to my show, you listen to those on a regular basis, you will find that many times you won't hear what we're talking about on the mainstream media, on MSNB or CEC or CNN or those until 2 or 3 days later. And I'm not bragging, I'm just telling you that's how it is. Well, and, you know, the story has come up this past couple of days about the same contractor involved in building that big albatross weight around the city of Wasilla's neck. A huge skating rink that she decided they had to have up there that's losing money hand over fist. Seems some of the people that supplied the building supplies for that also some maybe supplied the, or did, not maybe, did supply the building supplies for her house. Her $550,000 house that's on a lake. So, we don't know, we do know that Todd Palin said that he and some of his buddies built that house. Just a lot of interesting things that went on with that whole story. You know, Sarah Palin got building permits eliminated in Wasilla. That's a wide open town, Wasilla. I've been there years ago. It was much smaller than it is now. It was pretty much just a bump in the road. Can't remember if they had one or two stoplights then, but they did away with building permits, so there's no record about who did the actual building, what contractor, and the people involved. There's none of that. They do have completion permits there. Once the house is completed, they have to report that. So there's all this mystery surrounding her house now. A lot of mysteries surrounding her house. Did Todd Palin build that house? Also, of course, we know that the people that supplied the building materials for the skating rink and her house were big sponsors of Todd Palin's racing, his snowmobile racing. Why do they call it snow machine racing up there? Is a snow machine different than a snowmobile? Anyway... He sponsored Todd Palin's racing, this supplier did, and will not come out unequivocally and say that his people had no hand in building that house. He's just saying, well, gee, I really don't know. I don't know. Where there's smoke, there's usually some fire, and of course, the same builder, I might add, the same supplier, building supply person, supplied the building supplies for the Ted Stevens house. This is getting interesting, isn't it? So, the McCain... I apologize. The McCain-Palin campaign appears to have a problem. Of course, even if they... If we found out... that somebody built that house for them gratis and gave it to them and violated every law in the book, they would still stand there and deny it, just like she denied any culpability in this problem the other day about the trooper gate. Well, I'm glad I've been cleared from everything, that I didn't do anything more legally or ethically wrong. Although it says quite plain and simply that she did in the report. So, I don't know if this... will end up being anything, will it end up being a big kickback story, if it'll end up being anything at all. Who knows? But as it comes out, we'll report it. We weren't first on that story, but we have been first on some other ones. 866-546-5254. Did you hear about Rush Limbaugh, Mr. OxyContin himself, the drug-addled right-wing talk show host? Limbaugh, Mr. Truthful, Rush Limbaugh. I wonder, I've never had any OxyContin, have you? Does it really scramble your head that much? If it is a painkiller, from what I understand? And he was supposedly was taking it because he had a bad back or something or other, and it turns out he was taking like a handful of them in a day's time or whatever, and it's supposed to be like one every 8 hours from what I know, OxyContin. We know what he sounds like on OxyContin because there is no question, and I've mentioned to you this before, his criminal activity with the illegal drugs was exposed, I think most everybody that listened to the Limbaugh show knew that there was something seriously wrong with him, his slurring of his speech and all that he'd lost his hearing and covered that up and all. So we know what Rush Limbaugh sounds like. And do you know, I didn't know this until not long ago. I actually heard him admit it He has those cochlear ear implants in his skull to help him hear, but he still can't hear really a regular conversation. He's still, for all intents and purposes, legally deaf. Didn't know that. So it's meaningless to have a conversation with him, I guess, at a dinner table, all because he can't really hear you. But anyway, what I want to go on, he got in this little Donnybrook with Mary Mitchell, a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. And so Limbaugh yesterday, well, let me back up. Let me set this up for you. Chicago Sun-Times columnist Mary Mitchell called out Sarah Palin for inciting hatred at a rally, just like we've been talking about earlier in the program. And she got quite an angry response from Rush Limbaugh yesterday. And quoting Limbaugh here, he says, Mary Mitchell, a wuss, a wimp columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Boy, isn't that something? Rush Limbaugh calling somebody a wuss and a wimp. Pot calling. All right. Says that Sarah Palin should be censured. She says that Sarah Palin should apologize to the Obama campaign and the American people for her role in bringing out the worst in her supporters. This is laughable, says Rush. Come on, Mary, grow up. This is the big leagues. How about the people in your party? I know you're a Democrat, Mary Mitchell. You can't deny it. All you liberal media people are Democrats. What about the incitement of this whole country that you and your fellow journalists have engaged in along with the Democrat Party? You have gendered up hate for this president. You have ginned up a despise for the U.S. military. You have sought to convince the American people their country is worthless and sinking into the abyss. You've been doing it for 6 years. Limbaugh also called Mitchell a racist nutball. So, I don't think old Rushy boy, drugs or not, I don't think Rush knew that Mary Mitchell is not about to wimp out, not about to cave in to anything he has to say. And so she responded to him, and I love her response. She said, when you step on a pig's tail, it squeals. Rush Limbaugh is a squealer. And why is he squealing? Because John McCain and Sarah Palin are losing ground in a contest that they thought was theirs. And they're losing it to a black man. Of course, Limbaugh won't say that. Instead, on Thursday, he spent his time berating me for saying Palin needs to apologize for inciting crowds that hurled racial epithets at black members of the press. I'm a wuss, a wimp columnist, Limbaugh says, she says. So why would a multi-million-dollar squealer use his on-air time on a wuss and a wimp? The reason Limbaugh is squealing like a pig, the pig he is because he's the epitome of white privilege. He can't wrap his small mind around the fact that Barack Obama is kicking McCain's butt in the polls. And to make matters worse, how dare a black woman ask a white woman who's on the GOP ticket to apologize for the inappropriate behavior of her supporters. But my position is really a no-brainer, Mitchell says. Whenever a crowd gets whipped up to the point that they turn ugly and start hurling racist insult, it is common sense that the candidate moves to rein it in, but McCain is so desperate to win, he's feeding off those angry crowds. Come on. The squealer, meaning Limbaugh, was among the first to demand that Barack Obama denounce his former pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, for comments deemed offensive to white people. I repeat, had Obama fans acted a fool the way the McCain fan did, every pundit, with the squealer leading the way, would have demanded he offer some kind of apology. So Mitchell says, I'm the racist nutball, but the squealer is the one who made a fortune ridiculing black people at every opportunity. But I have a voice too. And all of Limbaugh's bluster and all the calls of his rabid followers won't be enough to silence me when bigoted bullies are running amok. And besides, I'm not running for vice president. Limbaugh's sorry-ass Palin is. If Limbaugh wants to spend his time trying to bully me, as they say in my neighborhood, bring it. This from Mary Mitchell, columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. And Mary, bully for you. Limbaugh should have known. She's a feisty gal. And I see the market right now is down 60 points, something like that. It has been down as much as 250. It has been up as much as, I think, over 300 this morning, at least to 250 or 60. Another odd day on Wall Street. I guess the bulls were running wild yesterday, and they had to take a breather today. Plan on talking when we come back from the break at the top of the hour. We're probably going to discuss the electoral map as it sits right now. And believe me, I enjoy looking at the electoral map right now. It's a thing of beauty. And we'll go over that when we come back. If you'd like to join us here, give us a call, 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. We'd like to welcome Elo back to the chat room. By the way, all of you listening at another venue, be sure and head on over to the Head On Radio Network chat room. All you got to do is sign in. Just takes a moment or so. You don't have to give a credit card number or personal information or anything. I'll just give you a password to get in there, and you need to do that. Join this crowd. We got quite a crowd on there today, and I like to think... I don't like to think. I know that this group in the chat room right now, they're very, very educated people in the political scene. They know very well what's going on in the political scene. 866-546-5254. And I agree with Bedtime for Bonzo. He said, ignore the market. It makes as much sense as a nest of field mice when you lift a hay bale. Some run up, others run down. That's very true. We'll talk a little bit about the market when we come back. It's nothing more than a Las Vegas style. Well, let's put it this way: all the regular people who buy stock are the gamblers. And the bankers and the Wall Street tycoons are the house. And you know how that works. And that's exactly how that works. They got a built-in, they do. They have a built-in advantage. We're going to stop for news coming up at the top of the hour. You're listening to the Guy James Show here in the Head On Radio Network. So don't go away. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Steelworkers gave GOP Vice Presidential candidate Sarah Palin the reception she deserved at a Republican fundraiser in Pittsburgh. Jesse Russell has the story.
The United Steelworkers joined with several other unions in downtown Pittsburgh on Friday to drive home the message that Vice Presidential candidate Sarah Palin doesn't represent union workers, even if her husband Todd is a card-carrying union member. The VP pick has used her husband's steelworker membership to try and win over blue-collar workers that may traditionally be less inclined to vote for a Republican. Palin was in Pittsburgh on Friday for a $1,000 per plate fundraiser, and the steelworkers said they led the march from their office to the Weston Convention Center so she could meet the union that represents her husband.
We think it's kind of ironic that although she and Todd run around the country bragging about being steelworkers and about their great union benefits, they didn't even have the time to come over and say hello to all the people that work hard for them every day. So we're going to go to them.
The march that was estimated to number between 200 and 400 was also used to point out that Palin has spent very little time, if any, speaking about issues important to working families, such as family leave and child care. He also wanted to remind voters that her running mate, Senator John McCain, seeks to privatize Social Security, would sign trade deals that would export jobs, and wants to tax employer-provided health care.
International Association of Machinists President Tom Buffenbarger is willing to join the talks to end the Boeing strike if he's needed. Talks began Sunday for the first time since the 27,000 union workers went on strike at Boeing. The strike has shut down Boeing aircraft production. The union says so far the strike has cost Boeing more than $3.7 billion, or roughly $100 million a day, in lost sales. Buffenbarger says the union is having a hard time in its efforts to end the strike. Issues include job security, retirement security, and health care. Economist Dean Baker says the U.S. will get through the financial crisis, but there's plenty of economic trouble to wade through before things rebound.
My expectation is we will get through the immediate financial crisis. There will be more bank failures, or that would be a lot of very bad news coming from the financial sector, but we will get through that. Now, we're still going to have a very serious recession. We have to switch from a situation where we were at a near zero savings rate to a situation where we have a normal savings rate somewhere around 8% household income.
Baker says if people begin to save more, they will consume less, and that will be a difficult but necessary economic adjustment. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Thanks for lending an ear.
He's practicing the politics of the past. John McCain. His attacks on Barack Obama, not true. False. Baloney. The low road. Baseless. John McCain. Same old politics. Same failed policies. Barack Obama supports a $1,000 middle class tax cut. An energy plan that takes on oil companies, develops alternative fuels, and breaks the grip of foreign oil. That's change we can believe in.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Throw the second switch! Throw the third switch!
Not the third switch!
Throw it, I say! Throw it!
The Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Fly! Fly, you hear me? Give my creation! Fly!
This was fun.
You're
going to
like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area. You have entered a restricted broadcast area.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us here in the Guy James Show today on the Head On Radio Network. Lots going on, eh? We've got another debate, if you want to call them that, tomorrow evening. What do you think? Will John McCain have the cojones to bring up the William Ayers incident? Or story? It's not really an incident, it's a story. Will he have the gonads to go ahead and do that tomorrow, do you think? Now, he's promised several people that that he will. If he does, I say that's the end of him. Absolutely the end of him and his campaign if he does that. That will put the grave marker on top of his dead campaign if he does that tomorrow evening. There's no question in my mind. And so, therefore, I hope that he does. I really hope that he does. And speaking of the electoral process, we were going to talk about that a little earlier. It's looking very, very bleak. Very bleak for the McCain people right now. Just about as bad as it gets here. Let me call this up here. I had a couple of them I was looking at. They've got to be feeling very, very bad in the McCain campaign at the moment. Looking at this, well, what do you know? It won't come up right now. Must be a zillion people looking at it. Looking at this Politico map, for one thing, they now have Indiana as a lead for McCain. They now have Virginia and North Carolina with a lead for Obama. They have Florida with a lead for Obama, Michigan, Wisconsin, Missouri with an lead for Wisconsin, or for Missouri with a lead for Obama, Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico, and of course in the camp we have Iowa, we have Minnesota, Washington, Oregon, Maine, New Jersey, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Delaware, Maryland, New York, Vermont, Illinois, California. It's got to be absolutely stunning to the McCain people when they look at this map now and see North Carolina and Missouri being put in the Obama campaign column. That would make the electoral vote right now, if the election were held today, that would make it 364 to 174. 364 to 174, and we still believe that states like Indiana might be able to swing. Might be able to swing. Georgia is just leaning right now. Georgia, can you imagine? So we've got a very interesting story on hand here with this Electoral College map. Let me look at the other one that I look at just about every day as well over at electoralvote.com. They have Florida leaning. They have West Virginia down to a... Now, this one is hard to believe. They have West Virginia with a weak Democratic lead. I don't know about that one. Ohio with the lead. Indiana, barely GOP. Nevada and Colorado with the lead. So, this one... Let me see where the total is on this one. This one has it, if it were today, 357 Obama, 181 McCain. And in the Senate races, if the election were held today, we have the Democrats getting 59 and the GOP 41, and the House Democrats getting 247 and the GOP 186. So things are looking good at the moment. No question, things are looking good at the moment. It's going to be interesting to see if these leads hold up. Several of these swing states have gone back and forth. And they could again. But what we see right now, what we have in front of us right now, this looks extremely good for Barack Obama. Don't give up the fight. Stay on it. It's something you can't give up on ever, right down to the last day. But I don't think it's going to be all that close this time around. I really, really do not think it's going to be all that close. Some of you, in fact, a great many of you, last week, when we played Franklin Roosevelt's Fireside Chat about the banking, I've got such a great response to that, and people ask for more, so I'm going to do that right now. I'm going to play a very lengthy piece of Franklin Roosevelt on talking about Social Security and how people were trying to put it in danger even back then. Yes, this is nothing new. So Franklin Roosevelt on Social Security, this is long, but it's interesting. And don't forget, it is by one of the great men, for my money, in the history of the world. There is no doubt in my mind, none at all, that this country wouldn't even be close to where it is today. It's hard for me to imagine that it would even be the country that it is today without one Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
My friends, last Thursday I described in detail certain economic problems which everyone admits now face the nation. For the many messages which have come to me after that speech, and which it is physically impossible to answer individually, I take this means of saying thank you. Tonight, sitting at my desk in the White House, I make my first radio report to the people in my second term of office. I'm reminded of that evening in March, 4 years ago, when I made my first radio report to you. We were then in the midst of the great banking crisis. Soon after, with the authority of the Congress, we asked the nation to turn over all of its privately held gold, dollar for dollar, to the government of the United States. Today's recovery proves how right that policy was. But when almost 2 years later, it came before the Supreme Court, its constitutionality was upheld only by a 5-4 vote. The change of one vote would have thrown all the affairs of this great nation back into hopeless chaos. In effect, four justices ruled that the right under a private contract to exact a pound of flesh was more sacred than the main objectives of the Constitution to establish an enduring nation. In 1933, you and I knew that we must never let our economic system get completely out of joint again, that we could not afford to take the risk of another Great Depression. We also became convinced that the only way to avoid a repetition of those dark days was to have a government with power to prevent and to cure the abuses and the inequalities which had thrown that system out of joint. We then began a program of remedying those abuses and inequalities to give balance and stability to our economic system, to make it bomb-proof against the causes of 1929. Today, we are only part way through that program, and recovery is speeding up to a point where the dangers of 1929 are again becoming possible. Not this week or month, perhaps, but within a year or two. National laws are needed to complete that program. Individual or local or state effort alone cannot protect us in 1937 any better than 10 years ago. It will take time and plenty of time to work out our remedies administratively, even after legislation is passed. To complete our program of protection in time, therefore, We cannot delay one moment in making certain that our national government has power to carry through. 4 years ago, action did not come until the 11th hour. It was almost too late. If we learned anything from the Depression, we will not allow ourselves to run around in new circles of futile discussion and debate, always postponing the day of decision. The American people have learned from the Depression, for in the last 3 national elections, an overwhelming majority of them voted a mandate that the Congress and the President begin the task of providing that protection, not after long years of debate, but now. The courts, however, have cast doubts on the ability of the elected Congress to protect us against catastrophe by meeting squarely our modern social and economic conditions. We are at a crisis in our ability to proceed with that protection. It is a quiet crisis. There are no lines of depositors outside closed banks, but to the far-sighted, it is far-reaching in its possibilities of injury to America. I want to talk with you very simply tonight about the need for present action in this crisis, the need to meet the unanswered challenge of one-third of a nation ill-nourished, ill-clad, ill-housed. Last Thursday, I described the American form of government as a three-horse team provided by the Constitution to the American people, so that their field might be plowed. The three horses are, of course, the three branches of government, the Congress, the executive, and the courts. Two of the horses, the Congress and the executive, are pulling in unison today. The third is not. Those who have intimated that the President of the United States is trying to drive that team overlook the simple fact that the President as chief executive is himself one of the three horses. It is the American people themselves who are in the driver's seat. It is the American people themselves who want the furrow plowed. It is the American people themselves who expect the third horse to pull in unison with the other two. I hope that you have reread the Constitution of the United States in these past few weeks. Like the Bible, it ought to be read again and again. It is an easy document to understand when you remember that it was called into being because the Articles of Confederation, under which the original 13 states tried to operate after the Revolution, showed the need of a national government with power enough to handle national problems. In its preamble, the Constitution states that it was intended to form a more perfect union and promote the general welfare. And the powers given to the Congress to carry out those purposes can best be described by saying that they were all the powers needed to meet each and every problem which then had a national character and which could not be met by merely local action. But the framers of the Constitution went further, having in mind that in succeeding generations, many other problems then undreamed of would become national problems. They gave to the Congress the ample, broad powers to levy taxes and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. That, my friends, is what I honestly believe to have been the clear and underlying purpose of the patriots who wrote a federal constitution to create a national government with national power, intended, as they said, to form a more perfect union for ourselves and our posterity. For nearly 20 years, There was no conflict between the Congress and the court. Then, in 1803, Congress passed a statute which the court said violated an express provision of the Constitution. The court claimed the power to declare it unconstitutional and did so declare it. But a little later, the court itself admitted that it was an extraordinary power to exercise, and through Mr. Justice Washington, laid down this limitation upon it. He said, "It is but a decent respect due to the wisdom, the integrity, and the patriotism of the legislative body by which any law is passed to presume in favor of its validity until its violation of the Constitution is proved beyond all reasonable doubt." But since the rise of the modern movement for social and economic progress through legislation, the court has more and more often and more boldly asserted a power to veto laws passed by the Congress and by state legislatures in complete disregard of this original limitation which I have just read. In the last 4 years, the sound rule of giving statutes the benefit of all reasonable doubt has been cast aside. The court has been acting not as a judicial body, but as a policy-making body. When the Congress has sought to stabilize national agriculture, to improve the conditions of labor, to safeguard business against unfair competition, to protect our national resources, and in many other ways to serve our clearly national needs, the majority of the court has been assuming the power to pass on the wisdom of these acts of the Congress and to approve or disapprove the public policy written into these laws. That is not only my accusation. It is the accusation of most distinguished justices of the present Supreme Court. I have not the time to quote to you all the language used by dissenting justices in many of these cases. But in the case holding the Railroad Retirement Act unconstitutional, for instance, Chief Justice Hughes said in a dissenting opinion that the majority opinion was a departure from sound principles and placed an unwarranted limitation upon the Commerce Clause, and three other justices agreed with him. In the case holding the AAA unconstitutional, Justice Stone said of the majority opinion that it was a tortured construction of the Constitution, and two other justices agreed with him. In the case holding the New York minimum wage law unconstitutional, Justice Stone said that the majority were actually reading into the Constitution their own personal economic predilections, and that if the legislative power is not left free to choose the methods of solving the problems of poverty, subsistence, and health of large numbers in the community, then government is to be rendered impotent. And two other justices agreed with him. In the face of these dissenting opinions, there is no basis for the claim made by some members of the court that something in the Constitution has compelled them regretfully to thwart the will of the people. In the face of such dissenting opinions, it is perfectly clear that, as Chief Justice Hughes has said, we are under a constitution, but the constitution is what the judges say it is. The court, in addition to the proper use of its judicial functions, has improperly set itself up as a third house of the Congress, a super legislature, as one of the justices has called it, reading into the Constitution words and implications which are not there and which were never intended to be there. We have, therefore, reached the point as a nation where we must take action to save the Constitution from the court and the court from itself. We must find a way to take an appeal from the Supreme Court to the Constitution itself. We want a Supreme Court which will do justice under the Constitution and not over it. In our courts, we want a government of laws and not of men. I want, as all Americans want, an independent judiciary as proposed by the framers of the Constitution. That means a Supreme Court that will enforce the Constitution as written, that will refuse to amend the Constitution by the arbitrary exercise of judicial power. In other words, by judicial say-so. It does not mean a judiciary so independent that it can deny the existence of facts which are universally recognized. How then could we proceed to perform the mandate given us? It was said in last year's Democratic platform, and here are the words, if these problems cannot be effectively solved within the Constitution, we shall seek such clarifying amendments as will assure the power to enact those laws adequately to regulate commerce, protect public health and safety, and safeguard economic security. In other words, we said we would seek an amendment only if every other possible means by legislation were to fail. When I commenced to review the situation with the problem squarely before me, I came by a process of elimination to the conclusion that short of amendments, the only method which was clearly constitutional and would at the same time carry out other much-needed reforms was to infuse new blood into all our courts. We must have men worthy and equipped to carry out impartial justice. But at the same time, we must have judges who will bring to the courts a present-day sense of the Constitution. Judges who will retain in the courts the judicial functions of a court and reject the legislative powers which the courts have today assumed. It is well for us to remember that in 45 out of the 48 states of the Union, judges are chosen not for life, but for a period of years. In many states, judges must retire at the age of 70. Congress has provided financial security by offering life pensions at full pay for federal judges on all courts who are willing to retire at 70. In the case of Supreme Court justices, that pension is $20,000 a year. But all federal judges, once appointed, can, if they choose, hold office for life, no matter how old they may get to be. What is my proposal? It is simply this. Whenever a judge or justice of any federal court has reached the age of 70 and does not avail himself of the opportunity to retire on a pension, a new member shall be appointed by the president then in office with the approval, as required by the Constitution, of the Senate of the United States. That plan has two chief purposes. By bringing into the judicial system a steady and continuing stream of new and younger blood, I hope first to make the administration of all federal justice from the bottom to the top speedier and therefore less costly. Secondly, to bring to the decision of social and economic problems younger men who have had personal experience and contact with modern facts and circumstances under which average men have to live and work. This plan will save our national constitution from hardening of the judicial arteries. the number of judges to be appointed would depend wholly on the decision of present judges now over 70 or those who would subsequently reach the age of 70. If, for instance, any one of the 6 justices of the Supreme Court now over the age of 70 should retire as provided under the plan, no additional place would be created. Consequently, although there never can be more than 15, there may be only 14 or 13 or 12, and there may be only 9. There is nothing novel or radical about this idea. It seeks to maintain the federal bench in full vigor. It has been discussed and approved by many persons of higher authority ever since a similar proposal passed the House of Representatives in 1869. Why was the age fixed at 70? Because the laws of many states and the practice of the civil service, the regulations of the Army and Navy, and the rules of many of our universities and of almost every great private business enterprise commonly fix the retirement age at 70 years or less. The statute would apply to all the courts in the federal system. There is general approval so far as the lower federal courts are concerned. The plan has met opposition only so far as the Supreme Court of the United States itself is concerned. But, my friends, if such a plan is good for the lower courts, it certainly ought to be equally good for the highest court, from which there is no appeal. Those opposing this plan have sought to arouse prejudice and fear by crying that I am seeking to pack the Supreme Court and that a baneful precedent will be established. What do they mean by the words packing the Supreme Court? Let me answer this question with a bluntness that will end all honest misunderstanding of my purposes. If by that phrase, packing the court, it is charged that I wish to place on the bench spineless puppets who would disregard the law and would decide specific cases as I wish them to be decided, I make this answer: that no president fit for his office would appoint, and no Senate of honorable men fit for their office would confirm, that kind of appointees to the Supreme Court. But if by that phrase the charge is made that I would appoint and the Senate would confirm justices worthy to sit beside present members of the court who understand modern conditions, that I will appoint justices who will not undertake to override the judgment of the Congress on legislative policy, that I will appoint justices who will act as justices and not as legislators, if the appointment of such justices can be called packing the court, then I say that I, and with me the vast majority of the American people, favor doing just that thing now. Is it a dangerous precedent for the Congress to change the number of the justices? The Congress has always had and will have that power. The number of justices has been changed several times before in the administrations of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, both of them signers of the Declaration of Independence, in the administrations of Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, and Ulysses S. Grant. I suggest only the addition of justices to the bench in accordance with a clearly defined principle relating to a clearly defined age limit. Fundamentally, if in the future America cannot trust the Congress it elects to refrain from abuse of our constitutional usages, democracy will have failed far beyond the importance to democracy of any kind of precedent concerning the judiciary. We think it so much in the public interest to maintain a vigorous judiciary that we encourage the retirement of elderly judges by offering them a life pension at full salary. Why, then, should we leave the fulfillment of this public policy to chance or make it dependent upon the desire or prejudice of any individual justice? It is the clear intention of our public policy to provide for a constant flow of new and younger blood into the judiciary. Normally, every president appoints a large number of district and circuit judges and a few members of the Supreme Court. Until my first term, practically every president of the United States in our history had appointed at least one member of the Supreme Court. President Taft appointed 5 members and named the Chief Justice. President Wilson, 3. President Harding, 4, including a Chief Justice. President Coolidge, 1. President Hoover, 3, including a Chief Justice. Such a succession of appointments should have provided a court well balanced as to age. But chance and the disinclination of individuals to leave the Supreme Bench have now given us a court in which 5 justices will be over 75 years of age before next June, and 1 over 70. Thus, a sound public policy has been defeated. So I now propose that we establish by law an assurance against any such ill-balanced court in the future. I propose that hereafter, when a judge reaches the age of 70, a new and younger judge shall be added to the court automatically. In this way, I propose to enforce a sound public policy by law. Instead of leaving the composition of our federal courts, including the highest, to be determined by chance or the personal decision of individuals. If such a law as I propose is regarded as establishing a new precedent, is it not a most desirable precedent? Like all lawyers, like all Americans, I regret the necessity of this controversy. But the welfare of the United States, and indeed of the Constitution itself, is what we all must think about first. Our difficulty with the court today rises not from the court as an institution, but from human beings within it. But we cannot yield our constitutional destiny to the personal judgment of a few men who, being fearful of the future, would deny us the necessary means of dealing with the present. This plan of mine is no attack on the court. It seeks to restore the court to its rightful and historic place in our system of constitutional government and to have it resume its high task of building anew on the Constitution a system of living law. The court itself can best undo what the court has done. I have thus explained to you the reasons that lie behind our efforts to secure results by legislation within the Constitution. I hope that thereby the difficult process of constitutional amendment may be rendered unnecessary. But let us examine that process. There are many types of amendment proposed. Each one is radically different from the other. But there is no substantial group within the Congress or outside the Congress who are agreed on any single amendment. I believe that it would take months or years to get substantial agreement upon the type and language of an amendment. It would take months and years thereafter to get a 2/3 majority in favor of that amendment in both houses of the Congress. Then would come the long course of ratification by 3/4 of all the states. No amendment which any powerful economic interest or the leaders of any powerful political party have had reason to oppose has ever been ratified within anything like a reasonable time. And remember that 13 states which contain only 5% of the voting population can block ratification, even though the 35 states with 95% of the population are in favor of it. A very large percentage of newspaper publishers and chambers of commerce and bar associations and manufacturers associations who are trying to give the impression today that they really do want a constitutional amendment would be the very first to exclaim as soon as an amendment was proposed, "Oh, I was for an amendment, all right. But this amendment that you've proposed is not the kind of an amendment that I was thinking about. And so I am going to spend my time, my efforts, and my money to block this amendment, although I would be awfully glad to help to get some other kind of an amendment ratified." Two groups oppose my plan on the ground that they favor a constitutional amendment. The first includes those who fundamentally object to social and economic legislation along modern lines. This is the same group who, during the recent campaign, tried to block the mandate of the people. And the strategy of that last stand is to suggest the time-consuming process of amendment in order to kill off by delay the legislation demanded by the mandate. To those people I say, I do not think you will be able long to fool the American people as to your purposes. The other group is composed of those who honestly believe the amendment process is the best and who would be willing to support a reasonable amendment if they could agree on one. To them I say, we cannot rely on an amendment as the immediate or only answer to our present difficulties. When the time comes for action, you will find that many of those who pretend to support you will sabotage any constructive amendment which is proposed. Look at these strange bedfellows of yours. When before have you found them really at your side in your fights for progress? And remember one thing more. Even if an amendment were passed, and even if in the years to come it were to be ratified, its meaning would depend upon the kind of justices who would be sitting on the Supreme Court bench. For an amendment, like the rest of the Constitution, is what the justices say it is, rather than what its framers or you might hope it is. This proposal of mine will not infringe in the slightest upon the civil or religious liberties so dear to every American. My record as governor and as president proves my devotion to those liberties.
Like the setting sun. there's still time. My one last wish, someday you'll see how hard I tried and how much you meant to me. It's your world now. Use well your time. Be part of something good. Leave something good behind. The curtain falls. I take my bow. That's how it's meant to be. It's your world now. It's your world now.
Ah, yes, it's your world now, and seems to me that's kind of what we're up to right now, isn't it? Trying to make sure that this country is ours and that it stays ours and not fall into the hands of a few. That it should be the country of the people, by the people and for the people, instead of a few. That's what this election is all about this time, more so now than perhaps ever before. I can't think of a time when our freedoms, our liberties, our financial well-being, our security, all of that, all things that are important to the American people, I cannot think of a time that's been more important in history than right now. That's why this election is so important. And yes, I am confident about this election. I'm feeling really good, but we cannot let up. Despite our confidence, despite my confidence, I don't know how confident you are, but I'm starting to hear from more and more people that they have great confidence in a victory coming up, and I feel that way as well. But we still got to keep, as they used to say, the pedal to the metal until it's over. And I think one thing that we can expect probably on November the 5th when it is announced, that, and I hope it's announced that we don't have any hanky-panky going on that causes another gruesome time like we had in 2000. But when it is finally admitted and conceded by the McCain-Palin campaign that indeed Barack Obama is the new president of the United States on November the 5th. I hope that America, all of America, will have the good sense to tone it down, to lick their wounds, their political wounds, get over it, and for a change get behind a new president that gives this country some hope. Frankly, I do feel very hopeful. And I know we're in a real, real tough time right now. A very, very tough time. And many people are suffering. Financially, health, many people are suffering. But I am hopeful that a new administration can bring hope, can bring some answers to the problems we now have, and get this country back on the right track. This is, after all, America, and despite all the troubles we have, I believe that we can get back to what we should be, what we could be, and resume the direction that the Democratic Party has taken us forward and upward for so many years, and then we run into this ugly thing that we've got now, this ugly situation. So I hope all this hatred can be put aside. I earnestly hope that. I sure do. 866-546-5254 if you'd like to join us here on the program today, kind of a laid-back show today. I've gotten a lot of email, one in particular from a guy, some Republican, I'm assuming, that said he didn't care to hear anything more from me about the economy because I didn't know my proverbial ass from a hole in the ground, and that I gave my opinions on it. Well, I am allowed to give my opinions on it, you see. Not only did I give a lot of facts about it, yes, I gave my opinions on it, and yes, I do know something about the economy, and yes, I do know enough for me anyway, about economics and how this country works economically. So if you're offended by hearing some opinions, why, turn the thing off, okay? That's all. And anyway, we had a long discussion with somebody by email talking about derivatives. And a lot of people really don't understand derivatives. And to break it down, and of course, derivatives are probably the number one reason that things have gone south economically, and probably the number one reason for all the financial institutions around the world. It's my opinion that what really caused this was the derivatives. And the best way to explain it is, and it's fairly difficult, but you can boil it down. Suppose you've got a neighbor whose house is worth $500,000, let's say, and that he's got a $400,000 mortgage held by the bank. Nothing unusual about that. He doesn't owe you any money, and you're no more than just neighbors and acquaintances. So I sell you a piece of paper for $5,000 that says I will pay you the value of your next-door neighbor's house if he defaults on his mortgage. So really and truly, what you've bought for your $5,000 is a derivative. That's what derivatives are. And why do you care if he defaults? You really don't. And what do you lose if he defaults? You don't lose anything. And what do you gain by him not defaulting? Nothing. So who gains by this silly-ass derivative? We both do. I gained the $5,000 by selling it to you in the first place. All it cost me was a few dollars to have a lawyer draw it up and create some legalese mumbo-jumbo. And you gain because you now have a secured debt obligation. That's what it's called. And it is secured because it's tied to the value of your neighbor's house, which you do not own, and upon which you do not now and never will have any real financial claim. But the face value of this secured debt obligation is $500,000. So you can show it to a banker, and this is exactly what's been going on all along. You can show it to a banker and borrow cash using this piece of paper as collateral. And the bank now has what it considers to be a secured loan for however much they loaned you on this thing. So now we've got the $400,000 mortgage, the $500,000 derivative, and a bank loan, all of it secured by this one $500,000 house. And when you add that all up, that's more than two times the value of the house, and it's riding on the homeowner paying the mortgage. And I've only sold one derivative against it. There's no limit on the number of derivatives I can sell against that house. That is why the derivatives market is estimated to be over $50 trillion, and every penny of it is play money. All of it. Derivatives are very simply financial instruments created for the sole purpose of making money, selling the instruments to people who are stupid enough or crooked enough to buy them. That's all that's involved, is being crooked or stupid. So your neighbor defaulting on his mortgage is not the real problem in today's crisis. Forget all that talk about the how the government can pay off his mortgage and everything will be fine, because his mortgage is not the problem. The problem is your derivative and the loan that you obtained based on it. Now, I have to pay you that $500,000 along with the others that I sold, and I can't do it. And since the derivative is now worthless, your loan has become an unsecured loan, and your bank is freaking out about that, and it can't afford to have all this unsecured debt on the books, and as a result of all that, the bank's got to obey the banking laws and stop lending. So your neighbor triggered the problem, but your derivative and your bank loan actually caused the problem. Nobody looked at your finances until your neighbor defaulted. That was the trigger. That was just the trigger. And then they looked at your books and they looked at mine, and as a result of his default, and they saw those finances were rotten and corrupt to the core, and then it all hits the fan, which is now what's happened. And yet politicians of both parties keep yammering about how the housing crisis and about how getting those mortgages paid. Listen, both talk about lack of regulation permitting the issuance of bad mortgages as having caused the present crisis, and promote paying off these mortgages as a solution. The Bush administration is still, even now, pressing to buy up as much bad debt as possible and to hold it until it regains its value, as if there's any hope that it ever will. To boil down this whole story, is your derivative and your bank loan ever going to have any value? No. Did they ever have any real value in to begin with? No. The answer to all this is the government's probably even more corrupt than our financial world, and no one wants to admit it. That's the sorry truth about derivatives, and if they think that just ending the bad mortgages is going to end all this, they're mistaken, and now we're going to pay out the bank to get rid of these derivatives. It's a hell of a mess, believe me. The more you dig into it, the uglier it gets. That's why I don't see any end to this financial mess anytime soon. Hey, golly, the hour's almost gone already. By golly. Thanks for listening today to the Guy James Show. As always, we're very appreciative to have all of you along with us. I'd like to thank Billy Shears, music director of the Guy James Show, and, of course, Bob, heading up the Head On Radio Network. Thank you for being there for all of us. I guess that's about it for today. Don't know where the time went, so hope to see you back here again tomorrow. You're listening to the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network. Don't forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. See you tomorrow, gang.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the site. Your host, Mark Levine, and I'm in a good mood. Yes, it happens. It's not always the case that radio hosts get on the air and yell and scream and rant about things they don't like. Okay, all right, that's our standard practice. But today, I'm in a good mood. Obama is up in the polls, and he's staying high, and nothing's really changing. He's, you know, minimum 5 points, maximum 7 or 8, as I watch my state of Virginia turn blue and start looking at other states turning blue. I kind of trusted Colorado and Virginia, but now comes Florida. Dear old Florida. And all those Jewish voters down there. And Ohio turning blue. A little bit tougher, but I think we'll get it. And Nevada turning blue. And then come the fun states, right? Missouri. A pretty, you know, one of those states that's kind of on the cusp, but generally more conservative than not, turning blue. The real fun one is North Carolina. Now, North Carolina has been red for a long time, but it does have a popular streak. Remember, they did elect John Edwards, and North Carolina, I think, will turn blue. You heard my prior discussion of the maps. I think you probably have. It's the Kerry states plus Iowa and New Mexico are in the bag. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, that's all of New England, okay? Basically, everything from Pennsylvania and Maryland and New Jersey and, Delaware and D.C., all the way up through the Northeast. And then you've got those Midwestern states, Minnesota and Wisconsin and Illinois, of course, and Michigan. And we're going to add Iowa and New Mexico. And then the other Kerry states were on the West Coast, Hawaii, California, Washington, Oregon. Well, we're adding some. We're adding Iowa.